Hebrews 8. Now of the things which we have spoken, this is the sum. We have such an high priest who is set on the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens, a minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched and not man. For every high priest is ordained to offer gifts and sacrifices, wherefore it is of necessity that this man have somewhat also to offer. For if he were on earth, he should not be a priest, seeing that there are priests that offer gifts according to the law, who serve under the example and shadow of heavenly things, as Moses was admonished of God when he was about to make the tabernacle. For see, saith he, that thou make all things according to the pattern showed to thee in the mount. But now hath he obtained a more excellent ministry, by how much also he is the mediator of a better covenant, which was established upon better promises. For if that first covenant had been faultless, then should no place have been sought for the second. For finding fault with them, he said, Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day when I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt, because they continued not in my covenant, and I regarded them not, saith the Lord. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, saith the Lord. I will put my laws into their mind and write them in their hearts, and I will be to them a God, and they shall be to me a people. And they shall not teach every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, Know the Lord, for all shall know me, from the least to the greatest. For I will be merciful to their unrighteousness, and their sins and their iniquities will I remember no more. And that he saith, A new covenant he hath made the first old. Now that which decayeth and waxeth old is ready to vanish away. Interesting chapter that we have right here. We concluded last week that the priesthood of Jesus is far superior to the Levitical priesthood. That's where we left off last week. This takes up from that point and moves us quite rapidly forward from that. Still trading on the old truth, on the truth that he gave us in the first part of the book. Go back to the 25th verse of the last chapter. Let's catch that up, because that kind of leads us right into where we were and where we are right now. Let's go right back there, and then we'll hit verse 1 and 2 again as we slide over into the 8th chapter. Wherefore, he is able also to save them to the uttermost that come unto God by him, seeing he ever liveth to make intercession for them. Intercession is also in this chapter that we're in 8 here. Several times it's talking about that intercessor. It's talking about the intercessor, the mediator, the high priestly role of the Lord Jesus Christ. For such an high priest became us, who is holy, harmless, undefiled, separate from sinners, and made higher than the heavens, who needeth not daily as those high priests offer up sacrifice, first for his own sins, and then for the people's. For this he did once when he offered up himself. For the law maketh men high priests which have infirmity. But the word of the oath, God's word, Father's word, which was since the law, maketh the Son, who is consecrated, set apart forevermore. So what we had was, we had the conclusion that the priesthood of Jesus is far superior to the Levitical priesthood that came before. Then we come into verse 1 of chapter 8 here. And it says that we have spoken of the things which we have spoken. This is the sum. When it's talking about sum there, it's not talking about a conglomeration of things that kind of that's boxed up together. What it's talking about at that point is the sum, the chief thing. Of what we've talked about before, there's one thing that's above all other things. There's one thing that rises to the summit of the idea, and the summit of everything that has come before us up to this point right now is that Christ, our high priest, is within the veil of the tabernacle that he built. and is seated at the right hand of God. That's the chief thought that we have so far. That is the summit. And as we begin to break that statement down, which he's given us here, we have such a high priest who is set on the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens, a minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched and not man. There is a ton that is being said in those two verses right there. And that is getting us to the summit. This is a summit, chief statement, far above other statements. If you get a hold of this one right here, you get a hold of what the Lord wants you to get a hold of as a Christian dying. Okay? He wants you to get a hold of this, and if it gets you get a hold of this and it gets a hold of you, it ought to change you. It ought to change the way you look at things. It ought to change the way you go about things. It ought to change everything in your life. We are not placing our confidence in a mere man. One of the things that that brings to light. He did not inherit the office as other men did. He did not inherit it. He is an eternal priest, according to what we see here. On the other hand, he's a man. He knows your frame. He knows what ails you. He knows your problems. He knows how things feel. He gets it because he's been through it. He can be trusted to know how you're feeling and how you're really doing. He didn't just talk a good game. He showed us. He bears the scars to prove it. And so this statement that we have here, talking about the true tabernacle, not made with hands, talking about a being above with Jesus Christ seated on the throne there, all of this is, if we want to, we can break it all down and it can really challenge us. It can also really encourage us as we see all of that. The true tabernacle is not in contrast at this point with the with heathen temples that are on this earth, but a contrast with Israel's tabernacle, which was temporary. Okay, so he's contrasting Israel's tabernacle, which is temporary, with one that is eternal in the heavenlies. The earthly tabernacle that was here was one that was divinely ordained. It was divinely ordered. God gave the pattern to Moses, and Moses then built that tabernacle to specifications that he was given. So even though God gave the blueprint, Moses was the builder. It was made with human hands, made with hands that were stained, and stained with sin. That's the contrast that we have between the earthly tabernacle and the heavenly tabernacle that is not made with hands. Okay? There was a stain on one, there's no stain on the other. The earthly tabernacle was a shadow of a reality. Down in verse 5, it talks about shadow. The shadow of heavenly things, as Moses was admonished to God when he was about to make the tabernacle. What he was specced to build was a shadow of the heavenly. Okay? And what I've been talking about, and I had somebody come up to me last week or week before and talk to me about shadows and substance and talking about types and antitypes, and I'm not really getting all of that. And so what we're really talking about here is pictures. We're talking about pictures in the Old Testament, under the Old Covenant. We're talking about a picture that's an earthly picture that is some like form of something that is above that, of something that is way better than that. And a shadow is a good picture of that. There is a shadow, and then there's substance that makes the shadow. Okay? You have to have substance in order for there to be a shadow. I remember as a youngster, I was scared of my own shadow at times. I was especially scared of shadows at night. All right? And laying in that bed at night sometimes with the light coming through the window or something right there, and sometimes there was something that got up on the wall there that just spooked me to no end. And I'd lay there sometimes sweating bullets, afraid to move, because that shadow, I know I'm the only one, because that shadow was on the wall or somewhere in there. And I'd sit there and just sweat, man, be rolling off of me, afraid to move or breathe, because whatever it was would know I was there and get after me. And then after a while, you'd watch or whatever else, and you figure out, that's a shadow. It's a shadow off of something. Maybe outside that's a tree or something's moving. And once you figured it out, you're like, oh, well, cool. But it didn't look nothing like that. Because what it looked like to me was something about 12 foot tall, had fangs about a foot and a half long, claws about 6 inches long, and was about to eat me to death, you know. It was a shadow. And when the real thing might have been a tree limb out there, it looked really, when you really looked at it, it really wasn't a good representation of what was there. It was pretty fuzzy according to what was there. And so when we have these Old Testament pictures, and we have these places where we're talking about this pictures in some way, some earthly way, Jesus Christ, or this pictures in some earthly way, the tabernacle that is made in the heavenlies, you got to understand that the light was shining from that place there, but it casts this shadow down here, and sometimes it don't look a whole lot like it, like what was the original was. But there are pieces of it that we can see that are connected. Okay, there are pieces of it that are connected. For example, another example of that is the Garden of Eden. Some of the language over in the first couple of chapters of Genesis there lead me to believe that the Garden of Eden was a cutting out of heaven. And so it was a shadow of the reality or the substance that was on the other side. And so when people talk about the beauty of this garden and the magnificence of this fruit, I'm like, well, yeah, but it don't even tell you half the story. Because if it's a cutting out of heaven, you ain't been told the whole story with all of that. But it's got to be magnificent because it is a shadow of something that is real in a reality, okay? So this is what we have here. We have this picture of this idea of a reality, perfect, sinless, absolutely stunning, not made with hands. And the light has shined through that, and the shadow that we have is the earthly tabernacle, okay? The earthly tabernacle. And I tell you this, those that saw and took part in the earthly tabernacle were just blown away by it. They were blown away by the tabernacle. They were blown away by the temples. Okay? And they were just shadows. Shadows of something wonderful that was out there in the heavenlies. A heavenly tabernacle not made with hands, perfect and eternal in its scope, and in its functionality as well. The Lord functions in a better tabernacle, is what this is getting at. He functions today in a better tabernacle, and from the throne of grace where He is seated next to the Father. All of these terms have meaning. All of these things tell a story. Seated. No priest ever sat in the tabernacle. There were no chairs in the tabernacle, okay? Ain't no priest ever sat in the tabernacle. Ain't no priest ever sat in the temple back in the day there. In the tabernacle of the Old Covenant, of the Old Testament, no priest ever sat there. You will search in vain to find what my brother just mentioned. You will search in vain to find a chair among the furnishings of the tabernacle or of the temple. Apart from the mercy seat which sat in the Holy of Holies. But I guarantee you, there ain't never been a priest's fanny set on that thing. Huh? Or at least one that lived to tell about it. Now, there might have been one that tried to park his fanny on it, but that's why they tied a rope to their feet. Huh? And put bells on the bottom of their robe, because sometimes they had to drag one up by their heels, all right, from beyond the veil. There might have been. Nobody's been back there but the Lord. And so there might have been one that tried it, but he didn't get away with it, because that seat ain't for a man. That seat's not for you to sit on. That seat is there and set apart for a very high and holy work at that point. So the Old Testament priests were engaged in a work, and they were engaged in a work that never ended. Their work was never done. That when they'd finished their work today, they start all over again tomorrow, because there was always something to do. So one more ritual, one more ceremony, one more sacrifice, one more something to be accomplished in that economy there. Their work never was completed. And when one ritual ended, another ritual began, and there was no end to the work of the ministry of the priest of the Old Covenant or of the Old Testament. Kind of reminds me, and you'll have to follow through with me here for just a moment if you will, but it kind of reminds me a little bit of a preacher's life, okay? You know the best moment in a preacher's life? The best moment of the week in a preacher's life was when the message is delivered. On Wednesdays and Sunday nights, those are the best times in a preacher's life. You have put things together. You have brought this message. You have brought this here. You've dealt with the aftermath. At the conclusion there, you've dealt with that, and you go home, and you make your way to that easy chair, and you sit there, and everything's fine. Everything's peace. Everything's good. You've delivered. You've come through these things, and you've sat there, and it's great. Those are the best times in a preacher's life, until he opens his eyes the next morning. And when you open your eyes the next morning as a preacher, you got to start all over again, because you got a deadline coming. You got a deadline coming Wednesday night. You got a deadline coming Sunday morning. And it's not like other jobs where you get a deadline and you go into the boss's office and say, you know, we're not going to make that this week. Let's push it back for a week. It don't work that way. That deadline's a solid deadline. And you get ready. You have no excuse. You have nothing out there that is to pull you away. You get ready for the next engagement. You got to do the work. You got to get with it. You got to make sure. Over 100 deadlines a year. And you go from one to the next, and the good time is right on the evening after you've delivered that. No expectations, nothing else pressing at that very moment until that next morning, and those deadlines come fresh and new on you. And so in that way, I can empathize a little with the Old Testament priesthood. We don't get to finish our to-do list. Other things on my to-do list have to go away. Other things on that to-do list have to be undone, because it comes down to having a priority with what must be done. And then if you get time, you get to the other things, and you allow those to take up. Jesus has been seated in the heavenly tabernacle. His work of redemption finished. Okay? The work of redemption finished, and he is seated. No more sacrifices to be made. No more blood to be shed. Any man who will repent and believe will be made whole, and that instantly. Work of redemption completely finished. Whosoever may come to the fountain that is filled with blood drawn from Emmanuel's veins. Because that provision has been made for all men to be saved. But the summit of thought for the redeemed, Jesus Christ seated in the heavenly tabernacle. That's the summit thought for those of us that have been born again. The summit thought is that Jesus Christ, in His completed work of redemption, is seated in the tabernacle in the heavens that is not made with hands, that is perfect in every way, every form, every fashion of the idea, and that He is seated there interceding, that He is seated there keeping us saved. That's a thought that's way up there. He is there keeping us saved. Saved and advocating on our behalf. And He's going to do that forever. He is for us. And in that role, seated in that completed work, He is ever for us. That's a high thought. That's big boy, big girl stuff. He's always available. He's always engaged. And He's always caring about our lives and what's connected with our lives. He is ever mediating. He is our perfect go-between. The go-between between our Father and us. Verse 3. For every high priest is ordained to offer gifts and sacrifices. Wherefore it is of necessity that this man have somewhat also to offer. Interesting phrases here. Ordained to offer. Ordained to offer. What did Jesus Christ offer? Early and quick answer is Himself. Okay? Obvious answer. He offered Himself. He did not offer the sacrifice demanded by the law because He's the end of the law for righteousness. He offered a better sacrifice. And that better sacrifice was He, Himself, and I. The old covenant at that point gave way to the new. The old covenant then was a distant memory in the rearview mirror. And the new covenant, the New Testament of His blood, comes in. The old and the new cannot coexist any longer. There will be no coexisting of these two priesthoods, of these two separate entities that are there now. He offered Himself on the cross. But listen to me. At the right hand of the Father, He's still offering. He's still in the process of offering today. He did offer Himself up once. That's done. It's past. It's over. But He's continuing to offer today. As long as we're in this flesh, you and me, as long as we're in this condition that we're in, our prayers and our good deeds and our best thoughts are all still messed up. All of that is still messed up. And so nothing messed up is ever going to enter the presence of a holy God. You with me? Nothing messed up is ever going to enter the presence of a holy God, God the Father. So our high priest takes our imperfect offerings, and there's many places that talk about that, with utterings and groanings and the Holy Spirit being able to take those things and making sense out of it. And when we don't know what to pray, the Spirit prays for us. And this is the same idea that we have of Him offering things up in that role of intercession and in that role of mediating between Father and the Father and us. So He takes our imperfect offerings and He perfects them. Perfects those offerings and offers them Himself to the Father. Covers them, massages, makes it right, makes it a form that the Father can accept. So He's still offering. Every high priest is ordained to offer gifts and sacrifices. He offered Himself up one time for all time, but He continues to offer certain things to the Father at that point. For if He were on earth, He should not be a priest, seeing that there are priests that offer gifts according to the law, who serve under the example and shadow of heavenly things, as Moses was admonished of God when he was about to make the tabernacle. For see, saith he, that thou make all things according to the pattern showed to thee in the mount. Basically, the presence of Jesus seated in the heavenly tabernacle demands the absence of the earthly tabernacle. There's a demand that is placed on that the earthly tabernacle goes away. The substance has come, and so when the substance comes, the shadow has to leave. All right? And so the old covenant, the old way, the old law, the old tabernacle, which was the symbol of that law, now is gone, has been done away with. There's no place for it in this economy. It says, if he were on earth, he should not be a priest. Okay? So earthly priests must be of the Levitical order, and they have to be of the tribe of Levi. Jesus was not of that. The earthly tabernacle was not suitable for the perfect Son of God. There was a tabernacle that was suitable for him, but it was not earthly. And that tabernacle was heavenly. So, was Jesus a high priest while he was on the earth? Well, yes and no. Yes, and then a farther fulfillment. Take a look, for if you will, go back in the book of Hebrews for just a moment. Hebrews chapter 2, looking verse 17, says, wherefore in all things it behooved him to be made like unto his brethren, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make reconciliation for the sins of the people. This is talking about the sacrificial role of Jesus Christ in that sacrificial role of the high priest. Go to chapter 5 for a moment. Verse 7. To save death and son, yet things suffered. No. Yes. Being made and obey. 6, as he said, saith also in another place, thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek, who in the days of his flesh, when it offered up prayers, supplications, strong crying, and tears unto him that was able to save him from death, and was heard, and that he feared, though he were a son, yet learned he obedience by the things he suffered, and being made perfect, he became the author of eternal salvation to all men, all them that obey him, called of God a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. Chapter 7. I'm going to give you the skinny on this in just a minute, just reminding you of what places here, even in the book of Hebrews, where he's been called that high priest. Chapter 7, verse 26, for such a high priest became us, who is holy, harmless, undefiled, separate from sinners, made higher than the heavens, who needeth not daily as those high priests to offer up sacrifice first for his own sins and then for the people's. For this he did once when he offered up himself. Now, it was a priestly function that our Savior performed on the cross when he offered his own body as a sacrifice. But we have to remember that under the Levitical system, the slaying of a sacrifice didn't constitute any offering to God. The slaying of the sacrifice itself did not constitute an offering. The slaughter had to be made on the altar, but the blood had to be taken and presented. On the mercy seat to God. Christ officially became our high priest after the resurrection. He officially became our high priest after the resurrection. On the cross, he offered the sacrifice, and then at the resurrection, he brought the offering into the presence of God. I believe that the encounter that Jesus had with Mary outside the garden tomb, I believe that the encounter that he had with Mary there was Jesus, our high priest, on his way to the mercy seat to make that offering at that point. If you want to go take a look at that place, John chapter 20 is where that encounter takes place. Let me just read one verse there, because it seems like an odd verse if you don't... If you don't read more into it than what you normally do. 20 verse 17. Well, verse 16. Jesus saith unto her, Mary. She turned herself and saith unto him, Rabboni, which is to say, Master. Jesus saith unto her, touch me not, for I'm not yet ascended to my Father. But go to my brethren and say unto them, I ascend unto my Father and your Father and to my God and your God. I believe that she, at that point, had caught him on his way to make that offering of placing his own blood on the mercy seat in that tabernacle in the heavenlies at that point. Touch me not, because there's a cleanliness issue that goes along with this as well, and so the ceremonial cleansing and such as that, and that he was on his way to make that offering there at that point. There's something far and away above what Moses had built. When Jesus sprinkled his own blood on that mercy seat, Judaism was set aside. Verse 6. But now hath he obtained a more excellent ministry, by how much also he is the mediator of a better covenant, which was established upon better promises. Here's where the author tries to let the Hebrew know that God hasn't taken anything from them, but he's provided something better for them. And see, that's the kick that we have, and the problem that we have with the Hebrew Christian is that it's on some level they thought that they were having something taken away from them. That because of all the to-do that had taken place for centuries up to this point, and all the ritual and all the hubbub and all the rules and all the regulations and all this sort of thing, that it was hard for them to see that there was something better for them, that they didn't need to latch onto that and keep that and keep moving that forward. And so the author of Hebrews right here is trying to make the case and trying to tell them, say, look, it's not that he's trying to that you're being deprived of anything. You got something better. There's something better that you're not seeing here. And you're latching on to something that is gone. You're latching on to something that's dead rather than something that's alive and that can move us forward with all of this. When you do a study and you take a look at the tabernacle and you look at the furnishings of that tabernacle and you look at the elaborateness of everything that took place, we're talking about a football field and a half long, all that took place, and three tribes on each side every time they'd come up and park their camel and get ready for the night. You have this big, huge structure that's in the middle of the camp, and the pillar and the fire and all of this sort, and God's presence there in the midst of all of them. This tabernacle was a symbol of all of that, and the veil and the gold and the altars and all of these things right here. And so all of this stuff and the way that it was done became ingrained in this culture, and it became ingrained in these people. And that moved forward even over into Solomon's temple. When Solomon's temple was built, boy, it was ornate. It was beautiful. It was awesome, man. That tent has now become a permanent fixture. But the idea still remained with all of the beauty that was attached with it and all the ceremony that was attached to it. And just this place was it. On earth, for the Hebrew, it was it. The tabernacle was it. And then the temple became it. And then Solomon's temple gave way to Zerubbabel's temple. And man, it was it. And then Zerubbabel's temple gave way to Herod's temple. And Herod's temple was it. I mean, it was it. In AD 70, whenever Jerusalem was raised, flattened, and the Roman army came in. Titus was the general that came in during that time. And they came in and they just cleaned house through there. And when they got to the temple, first thing they did when they got to the temple was threw torches inside. And they set the temple on fire from the inside out. They set everything in that temple on fire. Well, what happened is during that time, the Christians, and everybody was scared because they'd come in and they could do whatever they wanted, but the Christians began to run to the temple. I mean, the Hebrews began to run to the temple. Not so they could fight, but they were up there trying to keep them from tearing it up because it meant so much to them. And as they were coming, the Romans misunderstood their intentions and they began to kill them. And Josephus records that on the front steps of the temple there, that the bodies got so deep you couldn't crawl over them, and that the blood ran down into the streets from Hebrews coming in to say, please stop what you're doing, with no weaponry whatsoever. And they killed them, and they dropped them, and they were there. And as a result of all of that and what they had seen there, those Romans went through and took everything to the ground. Nothing left of that temple. Absolutely nothing left of that temple. Devastating. Devastating. This is something that they poured their whole life. Their everything was poured into this temple, into this tabernacle. It was everything to them. It was everything that everything was about to them. Okay? All the tradition, all the ceremony, all the pomp, all the everything was just so ingrained in these people. Now they've come under this new covenant. And all of that's still stuck in there. All of that's still stuck in their mind. All of that's still stuck in their heart. It's all there. I liken it to how we see things in churches. How we see things in churches even today. I got saved in 91, and I've been a member at four churches since 1991. Some of you been more, some of you been less. Anybody been less involved in less than four churches here in your life, in your saved life? Okay. One? Cool. I was involved in four churches. I got saved in one. Surrendered to preach in one, went to school and joined one while I was in school, went out of there and took my first church, left there and come to my second church right here. So I've been in four churches. And I've seen four different ways to do church. You would think that one preacher that comes from one church and goes to the next church would see that things are done pretty much the same way, wouldn't you? Try that sometime. Huh? Churches have ways of going about things. Have things that are sacred and things that aren't. And it takes a while to figure out what's going on with that and why that needs to be something that you take a look at. Listen to me, ladies and gentlemen. Sometimes we hold on to things like the old Hebrew hung on to the tabernacle. We hang on to things like old Hebrew held on to the temple. We try to mix two things rather than moving ahead with what is important. Remember what it said down there in the latter part of the chapter? It said that there's something new that's come in. And that something new that come in ain't in a tabernacle no more. It's not a temple anymore, per se. You see, what the old temple said was, come and see. Come over here and see. Come see God. Come see what God can do. Come see where God is. But the mantra of the new covenant is, go and tell. Go and tell, not come and see. Whole different idea. He says, we're going to have a new day. The new day is, I'm going to be in you. So there is a new tabernacle. There's a new tabernacle. There's a new temple, and it ain't this building. It's one that can be mobile. And to go anywhere and everywhere that the Lord commands, anywhere and everywhere that the Lord desires us to go, that we take Him to the ends of the earth, that we go to the ends of the earth, not rather than we stand on the street corner and say, come over here and look at us. Come over here and see. Come and look what our God's about. Come and see is the old way. Go and tell is the new way. Go and tell is the new covenant, the New Testament that he talks about here. And so there's a lot of really cool stuff that he's trying to put to rest here at this point. A lot of really cool stuff. I'm going to close with a little bit of an illustration about that. There was three preachers talking one time about all three of them had the same problem. We were up in Niagara, New York, doing a mission trip here many moons ago. And in our rumblings around, we were I think it was a Lutheran church, and it was very ornate, very stained, glassish. And they had a bunkhouse in there that we had rented and took up in there. And they had a commercial kitchen, which was another selling point. So we inhabited their building for a while. Well, they had bats in that place. And it liked to run a lot of the young gals out of the place with all that. So we had to go on a bat hunt to get them out. It reminded me of this joke. There was these three preachers that had bat problems in their church, and so they were talking together about how to get rid of their bat problem. And the first one says, "Well, we took care of our bat problem." He says, "All I did was I took some shotgun shells and took the shot out of it." He said, "I went into the auditorium in there and I shot that shotgun all it would shoot and run them bats right out of there." The rest of them said, "Well, did it work?" He said, "Yeah, except for they were back the next day." Next one said, "Well, I kind of solved our problem too." And he says, "Well," they said, "Well, how did you do that?" He said, "Well, We hired a scaffolding company. We put scaffolds up. We got up in there during the day while they was resting, and we got a net, and we caught them. We put them in a box. We drove 60 miles out of town, and we turned them loose. They said, well, did that work? I said, yeah, for about a week, and then they come back. Third one says, well, we did it different. They said, well, how did you do it? He said, well, we just went up in there and declared them all members. We hadn't seen them since. Got to be careful with you. Got to be careful with your traditions and things of that nature. Got to be careful with what you're upholding as something that is, whether it's something that's worth holding up or not worth holding up. Okay? And so this is the idea that he's giving here. He's talking about this heavenly tabernacle, the doing away of this system and this the Judaistic situations that are taking place there, and wanting these folks to kind of get with the program. Get with the program, and let's get moving forward with all that we have. I'm going to stop right there. We'll pick up next time around verse 7 or 8, wherever my memory kicks us back in, and we'll go from there.